For the ones who get it done, the most important part is the one you need now. And the best partner is the one who can deliver. That's why millions of maintenance and repair pros trust Grainger, because we have professional-grade supplies for every industry, even hard-to-find products. And we have same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders. But most importantly, we have an unwavering commitment to help keep you up and running. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, my name is David Marquet, and I'm here on the Agile Uprising podcast. Welcome all you listeners out there.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your tour guide today, Andy Cleff. This episode is the second in a series on leadership and was recorded live with audience participation. So as you hear in the podcast references to filling the lean coffee board, dot voting, deciding to continue or move on to the next topic, please don't try to play along. Now on with the show.
Hello, welcome to the second in a series of webinars where we explore the topic of adaptive leadership. The series is sponsored in part by Agile Velocity and the Agile Uprising. And today's theme will be intent-based leadership. My co-host today is Eric Cottrell. Thank you for joining me.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And we're delighted to be joined by panelists David Marquet and Andy Warshak. Both are team members over at Intent-Based Leadership, where they provide an incredible combination of inspiration, resources, and implementation to help organizations create leaders at every level. And before we close out today, we'll give you some more info on IBL. Gentlemen, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us back.
Yeah, it's great to see you. We have about 100 folks with us as well from all over the globe. And for those who have just joined, I will paste a link to our topic board into Zoom chat. You can add more questions to that board. If you see some things that you really want to talk about, dot vote. You got 3 votes. And after we get through our first question, we'll go to that board and see what bubbles up as the topics for today. Also put into chat some hashtags and some handles if you're in the mood to tweet. Here they are now. First question comes to us from Brené Brown's wonderful book, Dare to Lead, Brave Work, Tough Conversations, Whole Hearts. I'll throw it out to you, David, first. What, if anything, about the way people are leading today needs to change in order for leaders to be successful in a complex, rapidly changing environment where we're faced with this seemingly intractable set of challenges and an insatiable demand for innovation?
Everything.
Short answer.
Short answer, everything. Yeah, so
tell us more.
So there's a bunch of ways you can think about this. And it's sort of like, well, where do I start? And I'll give you 2 starting points. One is we call it push authority to information, or let the doers be the decider. So in other words, the original industrial age organizational design is authority up here at the top, information out here. The people who know what's going on don't have the authority to make decisions. So we have some system and we buy some software now, which will channel and aggregate their questions or their whatever it is up to someone with authority who will then come back with an answer and tell them what to do. And so the separation of information from authority makes the organization less resilient, less adaptive, less fun to work in because I'm doing what I'm told. So what you want to do is flip that on its head. You want to take the authority for making decisions and push it out to the people who are already doing the work. And this is one of the things that I think Agile really has when you do Agile right, what you're doing is letting the team who's doing the work have decision space over the work. Now, it doesn't mean they can decide, oh, we're going to write software, or we're going to write space shuttle software when you're normally writing banking software. But no one has unbounded constraints. So within the constraints, well, whatever we're trying to do, we let the people make decisions. Now, if that's all you start with, you'd be on a good track because everything else will, if you just start running experiments, well, how can we let people make decisions about the work? Everything else that we think we know anything about in terms of making it safe and tuning authority based on control and competence and using language and acting away, all that will come out in the wash. You're going to figure that all out. So that's a starting point.
Let the doers be deciders and give them a minimum set of constraints. Andy, what would you like to add to that?
Yeah, what I would add to that is that radically shifts the psychological ownership for what's happening in the organization to the people that are doing the work. And that's what happened on Santa Fe. David shifted that control to us. And it was a control issue for me. I'd been in the Navy for 13 years when I met David, and it was all about being controlled. And then I was trained to control other people. And when David shifted the control to us, the doers, it changed the way that we developed our teams. In fact, I used to teach my teams before David got there to think about what you're doing so you don't make mistakes. Because when you make mistakes, you give away any control that you have. And it's the more mistakes you make, the less control you have over your life. And then I had this captain come onto my submarine. And instead of having to worry about how much control I was going to give away, he gave me control to run my organization. And for me, that's the piece that needs to shift in today's work environment. This idea that we can control people, it's wrong, it's impossible. And as long as we believe we can do that, we try to find ways to do it. And it's such a waste of time and effort, especially when you compare it to giving control to people, what happens. And, just a quick short story, when David gave me control, I went from planning my way out of the Navy to doing another 10 years of serving my country just from that experience.
Huge lift in engagement. There's a good follow-up question from one of the participants. It says, it implies that folks have the needed information that sometimes only leadership has.
Right.
So when you let the doers be deciders, how do you ensure they have sufficient information,
right,
even about the constraints?
Right, exactly. So you don't just say, do whatever you want. I trust you to do whatever you want. That's not a good approach. I'm going to show my little iceberg over here, which is basically I'm talking about giving control, like Andy said. So giving control rests on the twin pillars of technical competence and organizational clarity, which is I can't let you make decisions about fill in the blank unless you know something about fill in the blank. Can't let you make decisions about coding an application if you don't know anything about coding, obviously, about the nuclear reactor, whatever it happens to be. But this other part over here, clarity, is very important. Typically, in healthy organizations, the team feels responsible for their own technical competence. I got to feel responsible for my knowledge about my job. Clarity, what we're trying to achieve. So when we say the information, there's a couple kinds of information. One is just coordination across the team. But the other is, what are we trying to achieve? And leaders, one of the joys of just telling people what to do is you don't have to waste a lot of time explaining why we're doing it a certain way. Like, just do that. No, you can't give the discount. Yes, you're going to launch the product. No, don't include that feature. And I don't have to waste a lot of time. So yes, is exactly right. And it's not a free lunch. You got to spend time explaining what you're trying to do. And over and over and over again, when I was like, why are you guys doing this? Why are you doing it that way? It's, well, because this, did I forget to tell you our mission changed? Like, it would be as ridiculous as that. Oh, did I forget to tell you that the aircraft carrier, I get a message, double top secret message that says the aircraft carrier position has changed to someplace over there. In the meantime, for some reason, we didn't circulate it around the submarine. And so the team's still thinking, well, this happens in business all the time. The mission changed, the product changed, like COVID-19. Oh, things are changing. Well, the ultimate mission might be the same. How you guys are going to implement it will change. But 100%. But if you start by just giving people control, here's what we say. You got a choice. Do I, A, give people a little bit of control, see what happens? Or do I wait until you prove that you're supremely competent and you know exactly what we're trying to do, and then I'll give you a modicum of control? Well, you could do that, but the sun's going to be a black hole before anything happens. So we always said, yeah, just give a little bit of control, but not in a huge way, just in a small step. And see what happened.
Yeah.
And you might be saying, oh, well, our work is too important. We do, whatever it is. And I'm not trying to minimize it, but we were on a nuclear submarine. But this is why I think intent's a magic word, because with intent, Andy would say to me, hey, here's what I intend to do. with the sonar system. And I always still had Vita. So it felt very safe for me. And hopefully it felt safe for Andy.
I'm going to screen share for a moment and get over to the Lean Coffee Board. So we're going to be in this view for just a few moments. And we're going to go ahead and see the topics. And we've got quite a few. So the first one, I'll read this out. And then we'll rotate. So the first question is, how can one be a change agent to bring mid to senior level managers who are not on a agile squad, but whose direct reports are, into the agile mindset? In short, how do you thaw out the frozen middle while being agile at scale? Thoughts? Toss up.
Well, yeah, I just heard a great response to this. So one of the things that we do internally with our global partners is we have these Friday storytelling sessions. And so the guy we had on today, his name is Michael McCleave. He works at James Madison. He teaches leadership to college students. No, it's worse than that. He teaches college students how to teach leadership to college students. So when COVID-19 hit, they had to adapt because everyone's at home. An amazing story. So this is basically the question I asked him. And here's what he said. He said, look, here's what I tell my kids, because they're going to go to jobs. I'm treating them this way. I'm letting them think. I'm letting them make decisions. And they're going to go get their first job where they're going to be an intern at Goldman Sachs. And they're going to be sit here, do that, do what you're told kind of deal. And he said, first step one is prove your competence and clarity. Don't start telling your boss what you think you should do until you've proven yourself here. And then you walk yourself up the ladder. Now our tool is, and it's directed for leaders to invite people up this ladder. So we say, hey, here's, what do you see? What do you think? What would you like to do? What do you intend to do? Or maybe just go do it. Well, you can flip that on its head. So when you go to your boss and you say, hey, tell me about this decision that we got to do. Tell me more. Give me your thinking on it. And these conversations happen. They grow over a month or two. And then you become the curious, helpful person who's trying to solve the problem. Don't just jump and say, well, yeah, this is what I'm 22. I know everything in the world. This is what I think we should do. I mean, I tried that a bunch of times. Doesn't really work very well, I can tell you. Andy's better at this. Andy's better at this than me because he was forced into it. I went to the Pentagon where I should have done something smart, but I was just sort of the annoying, hey, I think that's a bad decision. You know, hey, there's a lot of nuance to invading Iraq. Maybe we should talk about it more. No, we're good.
So I set a 5-minute time box on that. So we get another minute or two. Anybody want to pile on how to thaw the frozen middle?
Well, the other thing is we act our way to new thinking. This is where most organizations get, quote, change wrong. It's like, oh, let's create a theory. Let's create a philosophy. Let's create, give a speech. And then, oh, magic, things are going to change. So you take one little tiny thing and you create an organizational culture where that habit is practiced. So like, say, for example, we're going to run a bunch of experiments as opposed to a bunch of initiatives. You start changing the language. You change from they to we. You change from I request permission to here's what I intended. So I would tackle in really small steps just a piece of the language. And so the behavior start to change.
One of the things that I also feel happens is that leaders are oftentimes left out of the agile process. All of the effort and energy is going to the teams. They're trained, they're given the coaching resources, they're brought through the new processes, the new language and all that kind of stuff. But the leaders oftentimes are on the side sort of watching this thing happen. Or in some cases, they're not watching it because they are going to the Pentagon or they're getting briefed on this new thing about the ship being in a different location. And so they're dealing with their own stuff and they turn back to their teams and everything is different. So in some cases, a lot of it just comes down to making sure that somebody somewhere is taking those leaders and having moments with them to talk to them. What are they experiencing? What are they saying? Because a lot of times leaders actually want to be able to help. They just don't know how. And some of the old models and the old plays that they used to run, they come to the forefront just because that's what's normal and comfortable, but they just need somebody who's going to come to them and talk to them, not tell them, not try to preach to them or convince them this, but just find out how this is going for them and build rapport and relationship and just have a conversation and start the key topics that need to come up in terms of decision-making or authority or how we're moving forward. And surprisingly enough, a lot of times leaders just don't have any insight into what's really happening and how it's affecting people. And they would love to have that in a non-pressure, non-formal setting. So I think a lot of it can be resolved through communication, conversation.
Thanks. So that's the end of the time box. The folks that are on the Lean Coffee Board can vote whether to extend this topic a couple of minutes or move on to the next one. And majority of early and voters.
Kill it.
Hey, kill it. All right, Eric. All right. Can you grab the next one?
Yep. So the question is, did it just change on me, Andy?
It's at the top.
Okay. How do you shift the mindset of an organization to see the value of working together as a whole versus operating in hundreds of individual organizations when there is not an opportunity to select these leaders, employees of a local association or a bureau? So it sounds like a fairly complex environment. So,
well, I don't think you do. They go out of business. Really?
Simple answer.
Well, I mean, look, okay. I'm looking at the, sorry, I got two mine. I'm looking at the
That, we're getting a little bit twisted
the lean,
here.
The Lean Coffee. Say it again. I'll try and be less smug next.
I think it disappeared on us.
Yes. Unfortunately, somehow it disappeared. I think that.
All right. Here's one. I got one.
It's about how to change the mindset of the people at the top of the organization.
I think when there are lots of silos and there are independent entities trying to come together to create a holistic, when it's not really a holistic whole, but it sort of operates holistically, but they're actually siloed and they're individual functions.
It's got to come from the top and they got to believe. I mean, look at Boeing. You're not going to convince the CEO and the past CEO of Boeing that they need to be different until they get whacked pretty good. Even then, they're in total denial. And they, I don't know if you guys read, but there was an internal report that they did. It was the chairman of one of the board members, who was a retired 4-star admiral, led the report. And it was a total whitewash. It was like, oh yeah, right, we don't have any problem with our culture. We don't have a problem with people. And then these texts come out from the pilot saying, oh my God, I just lied to the regulators. I feel so much pressure. The thing's going crazy in the simulator, blah, blah, blah. No, you're not going to convince those guys that what they've been doing, you became CEO, you make millions of dollars a year, but now I'm telling you that's all wrong. It ain't going to work. I don't think, I have no optimism for that. Like, go away, don't never come back, and we'll have some enlightened people too.
So what do you really next think, topic, David?
so here's a related topic, right?
Sorry,
love to hear your thoughts. No, that's straight on. That's why we're here.
Straight up. Yep.
So we'd love to hear anybody's thoughts, David or Andy's, on implications to leadership roles as we scale or descale at the enterprise, right? So you take something like Boeing, what happens to leadership roles?
I think one of the things that I've dealt with here in the groups that I've worked with is the value of a person is what they produce, what they sell, and not how they grow the organization, how many leaders they develop. It's as simple as your value is how many followers do you have? That's your value. The reality is you're much more valuable to an organization or to a team if you develop more leaders. If we go back to look at Santa Fe and what our value was to the Navy, my value was how good of a sonar technician could I be? Nobody cared if I developed 10 more chiefs that could run a sonar division or chief of the boat, which was the highest level. Nobody cared if I could develop more. And so there's this, I'm not touching that because then I lose my value and what happens to me in the organization. That goes back to question one. That has to change. That has to change. Our real value is developing more leaders and more leaders that are better than we were. Santa Fe, I think, is a good example of that. David developed 10 subsequent commanding officers. That's 10 times the average of another submarine. We rolled out 7 more enlisted guys that reached the highest levels of enlisted leadership, which is about twice what another submarine does. And that's the piece I think that needs to shift, is the value of developing more leaders is equal to or better than the value of production.
We have a saying, it's outcomes over outputs. And I'm curious, David, when you took the helm of the Santa Fe, what were the metrics of success at that point? Did that change? Was it how many people renewed, or was it how many red marks you got on the inspection?
No, I was acting contrary to my best interest by investing my time and energy in developing my people. I had to deliver, and so did Andy. Every minute we spent helping someone learn how to think like a captain so that the Navy would then promote them to be a submarine captain or a command master chief was a wasted minute from the Navy's perspective. And it's even worse than that because so there's a ceremony. So when after my 3 years are up, it's called change of command. A new captain comes and he says, I relieve you. And I say, I stand relieved. And as of that moment, if the ship just sank next to the pier 10 seconds later, it's not on me.
Wasn't your problem.
Is that the, not the other guy. And so there's no, and I was working with the Air Force. This was several years ago. I was working for the Air Force who was doing some really good stuff in leadership. So I was the head personnel guy in the Air Force. Good stuff they were thinking about. And I said, well, if you guys really want to revolutionize the way people think, then give a leader a evaluation. It's called a fitness fit rep is what we call them. And give them an annual evaluation 1 year after they leave an organization based on how well the organization performed without them. And I just think about how revolutionary that will be. So you're then there knowing you're going to get evaluated on how well your team does after you're gone. Mm-hmm. Now you've invested your time and training in quote training. You're going to help them be better human beings. And whatever magic you have as a leader, you're going to be working day and night to transfer that to them. That's what leadership is. Now, they didn't do it ultimately because they said, oh, there's too many variables that aren't in control and all this kind of stuff. Well, anyway, I thought it was a clever idea. But the bottom line is you need a mechanism to create that mindset where I'm going to get evaluated. Yeah, you got to do production. You got to write lines of code. For Andy and Sonar, no one would have cared how many chiefs that Andy helped get promoted if Andy wasn't a supremely competent and effective sonar. So that's like square one. No one cares how good your culture is when you go out of business. Like, oh, Blockbuster, great culture. Who cares? Right? It's when we say, oh, Apple, good culture. Now you got my attention.
It's a huge shift. And you covered it in your book, Leadership is Language. And it's a rethinking of Taylorism and Henry Ford and tossing it away and saying it's not about the hands. It's about the hands, the heart, and the mind all together.
Yeah, because machines and algorithms are taking over the doing work. To me, it's not that complicated. There's doing and then there's thinking. And you're thinking about how to make the doing better. But the doing is the work. The doing is writing code, flying an airplane, running an operation, whatever, listening to contacts on sonar. And everything was about doing. And in an industrial age organization, we separated people into, it was a caste system. These people are the doers. So when Andy came up in the enlisted Navy, so those are the doers. They wore different uniforms so we could tell them apart. But you go to an organization, you can also, I go to a hospital, I can say, oh, that's staff, those are nurses, that's probably a doctor. Because we have cultural symbols to throw us into this caste system. Oh, the doctors make decisions, the nurses execute what the doctors tell them to do. So we divide. So what you want to do is like, no, Andy, you make a decision. You tell us what, like you're closer to it. You tell us how we should arrange the sonars. Anyway, it's...
Yeah, so there's a related question, but it also stimulated a thought. You know, now that we've moved to virtual organizations, and this is our new office that we're looking at, there's no plush carpet, there's no big mahogany desk, there's no trappings of hierarchy anymore. How does that change how we show up?
Well, I think it's epic. I mean, everyone's square is the same size. It's not like, you know, I could have, you know what? If some industrial age dude designed Zoom, your square would be as big as your salary. It'd be like proportionate to your salary. I'm literally like, you go to these meetings and people are sitting where they're basically sitting in salary order down the table. It's like really? And like here's what I want to say though. There's this thing about now we're in crisis. So we're going to go back to command and control. This is the reason you have to go back to command and control is because you've done a crappy job getting your team to think. So now when things change, we're in a different situation. So we don't have competence in the situation, or we lack clarity. So your urge is to go back to command and control. If you feel like you got to go back to command and control, it's because you've done a crappy job over the last 2 years letting people make their own decisions and going through the exercise of building the habits and the muscle of distributed decision-making and thinking. You've kept it to yourself. So now, yeah, you're going to get punished.
So that's really the question that's popped up. So how do you either politely or with a big hammer get leaders to recognize that that way cannot return? Or if they're still managing that way, it's not going to get them the best results. Warshak, what do you think?
Yeah, so I saw that pop up and I was just laughing because that was my struggle. My struggle as a middle manager for David, one of David's 14 chiefs. There was four of us on board that when David showed up, gave us control, I think we probably scared him a few times because we took more control than maybe he intended us to have. But then there was this other group of guys that they were, David's giving you control, so when something goes wrong, he can blame you instead of taking responsibility, which didn't make any sense to us at all, because accountability and responsibility don't go away when you shift control. Oftentimes people think that Santa Fe was just a bunch of people going off in a billion directions. No. David was still the captain, which drove conversation. It was David, this is what I intend to do. And oftentimes David would say, very well, Chief, thanks for letting me know. Let me know how it goes. But there were other conversations that were, Andy, listen, I didn't share this with you. Does it change your intentions? And we could have that conversation. That was a beautiful part of it. But convincing these other guys that it was the right thing to do, I would say probably conservatively, we had one or two, maybe three chiefs that never thought that was the right way to do. We were conditioned to tell people what to do. That's what chiefs do. And to do what we're told. And they did not see as clearly the value that the rest of us saw. And so I think convincing them was, well, gosh, man, I don't know. I think for me, I had so much freedom and so much latitude to do what I knew needed to be done that was the convincer for a lot of the slower guys to get on board. Man, Andy's leaving the boat at 11:30 to go jog, and I'm down here busting my butt working, and all his work is done. Why is that? Well, the reason is because I gave my guys control over the work that they were going to do, how we were going to get it done. And when they told me what they intended to do, if it made sense, then I let them do it. If it didn't make sense, then we'd fill some gaps in competence and clarity. But when guys started to see that, it was that, I think, changed some minds. But they see the success. They see the freedom. I had time to think about what needed to happen next. I was out of the reactive mode. Most of my career was reacting to something. And I was done with that after learning how to give control and David giving me control. And you don't change everybody. And that wasn't our goal. In fact, one of the things that I really loved about working with David is he invested in those of us that would take the responsibility for having control. And if you didn't, I can't speak for David. I don't know how much sleep he lost over the one or two or three guys that didn't, but I know for my guys, I didn't lose sleep over them. If they could do the minimum, that's what they got, and awards and pay followed that. And some self-selected out. It's I think just for and the other guys in the service now, this is kind of interesting. I'll let David jump in on this. Other submarines just assumed that David was giving better orders, had no idea that David wasn't giving any orders. We were running the ship. But as they figured that out, it's changed some of the culture in the service. In fact, the other services are using intent-based leadership in their training. We watch other submariners that use the language that we used on Santa Fe. It's amazing to watch that change. But it wasn't, I think, we didn't waste energy over trying to be perfect. You weren't going to get everybody. And the guys that didn't get on board self-selected out.
Yeah. So David, just a quick follow-up for you. How did you resist reverting when things got tough or didn't go well? And Andy's going to hold you honest if you really did resist.
Look, this is a great, you will fail. It's like when you're on a diet or you say, I'm going to run every day. And then one day, a whole bunch of things conspire against you and you don't run or you eat more than you meant to. You will fail. And stress, uncertainty, lack of sleep, all these things will be factors in you failing. But I had made a verbal, a public commitment to not tell my guys what to do. And I would say, hey, if I'm telling you what to do, I want you to like flag that. Of course, it was when I was tired, angry, frustrated, anxious, uncertain that I would revert back to doing that. So it was a, hey, you're telling me what to do again. I'm like, ugh. But you need external. I think you need, so it's two things. One, you got to shape the environment. The secret to having good willpower is not need willpower.
put the chips away.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't have any, if you never buy chips, then they're never in your house. You never have to worry about chips. You're never going to eat chips. So, and it's not about having chips in your house and not eating them. That's, if you don't eat chips, that's just dumb. So it's about shaping the environment. And then it's about getting external feedback. And it's not about, well, I got to beat myself up. I didn't have enough willpower, especially at the end of a long day. You have resource depletion. And it, for me, you're going to, every time someone comes to you and says, what should I do about this? And the answer pops into your head. And should I launch the product? Should I not launch the product? Hey, what do you think? What do you think we should spend the time on? This feature, that, like, boom, you know the answer. And every time you say, oh, hey, well, why don't you tell me more? It takes a toll. It's going to eat away at your cognitive resources. You need to recognize that. And at the end of the day, you're not going to be as good. You're not going to be as good. And that's give yourself permission. Yeah. At least for me, I wasn't. But you can practice.
That's a perfect segue into the next question. So, Eric, this is from the other side, right? Mm-hmm. Giving up control and then receiving it.
Yeah, so basically empowering the team. So someone wrote, I'd love to hear your thoughts on inspiring leadership in team members who may be reluctant to assume leadership roles. Doesn't sound like they're saying they're resistant, just sounds like they're more reluctant. So how did you guys handle those situations?
Well, there was a lot of reluctance because we'd been conditioned to do what we're told. And for many guys, there was a significant reluctance to assume that leadership role. So what happened on Santa Fe was you never stopped. David never stopped trying to give that control, especially with the reluctant people. But not everybody took what was offered. David built this relationship with us, built this trust that I'll tell you, the first thing that he said to us, my group, was we were done worrying about making a mistake. It wasn't our problem. He was the captain. The buck stopped with him. Our job was to focus on being excellent. And he knew, and we knew that we were still going to make mistakes. But for us, that meant we didn't have to worry about that. Were there consequences? Yeah. You know what? You dive a submarine without all the hatches shut, we're not coming home. You have to be good at what you do.
Bad thing.
But when our focus shifted from what could go wrong to how do we do this to best, it opened the door for some of the reluctant guys to take those leadership roles. So for me, it was the constant access that we had to David, which meant that he didn't lead the submarine from his office. I mean, we saw him everywhere all the time. We're pretty sure that he slept on occasion. It's a little bit of a joke. The nice part about having 135 thinking active people running your submarine is you get some rest. I work with other guys, none. Go ahead.
It's just, you're reminding me, you're taking me. So one of the things, one of the coolest things to do with the submarine is go, we call mano a mano submarine warfare. Our submarine against your submarine. And it's actually, from a strategic perspective, it's not the best way to use a submarine, in my opinion, but it's like dueling. And here's the difference. Even if I had another submarine, which is that exactly all the same technical specs of the USS Santa Fe, we would still kick their ass. Why? Because eventually their captain, who's running everything, would get tired and he would go take a nap, or he'd be tired and he'd make a mistake. I didn't have that problem. I would take a nap, I'd come back, and everyone was still, we had trained such a deep bench that, and we see this in organizations, is that organizations make mistakes because the decisions are made at the top. You actually want decisions made one level below, at least one level below the top, because that separates the decision maker from the decision evaluator. As soon as you make a decision, you should then exclude yourself from evaluating that decision, because you've contaminated yourself. When you make a decision, you've just attached your ego to that decision. And you may be enlightened and you may try to separate those, but there will always be a small attachment. And so the ability of leaders to evaluate decisions that they've made themselves is corrupted. And so what you want to do is never make a decision. If you're the captain on a submarine, the captain on a cruise ship, the captain on a tanker, the CEO of an organization, every time you're like, oh, we should do this, we should launch 737 MAX, we should blah, 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 you've now corrupted yourself and you're now not dispassionate and unemotional about that decision. And neither is the rest of the organization, because they know it's your thing.
So what I'd like to do is ask a really specific follow-up. So I see that our time is up, but Andy, you said that it was about building trust. So my question is there an example of where somebody stepped on it, right? As I read the first book, you know, Turn the Ship Around, I was like, oh my God, these guys are kicking cables out of the wall and the ships, you know, it's just all of this stuff seems like, oh my gosh. So when a mistake actually happened, do you have a real specific example of like what went through your mind? Like, because that's part of it, right? Like playing it out, like, okay, so when did it actually happen? When did something go wrong and how did you guys react? And why was it different?
You want to tell? You know what? I'll show the picture. You tell the story.
I missed that, David. What'd you say?
I was gonna say you tell the story and I'll show the picture.
Okay, let's see if he comes up with this picture. Man, the first mistake that happened on the submarine was a guy operating a switch that had been tagged not to operate. And I'll tell you, the rest of us on the submarine, we were like, now we're gonna find out who David is. How hard is he gonna punish this guy? This guy's gonna wish he'd never been born. And that's not what happened. And I think David's going to add some stuff to that, but I'll tell you, that was not my aha moment, because it was, to me, in my mind, and David can confirm or deny this, that it was easy for him to stick to the principles that he'd shared with us about how we were going to handle that the first time. It was the second mistake that for me was the aha moment, when David took the same approach. Let's solve the problem. Let's create the environment that helps people to solve the problem and not take the default method of how miserable can we make a person for making a mistake. I'm done, David.
Yeah, I couldn't find a better picture, but the operation is what I'm showing you in the back here, which is you pull the submarine to the end of the pier, you want to shut down the reactor, but you still need electrical power. So there are these big, heavy 400 amp, 440 volt cables. There's four of them. You got to connect them. And we put these red tags on the breakers and the sailor inadvertently. It's a big deal. Normally you would find them, you could reduce them in rank, and there'd be a permanent, their earnings for life would be permanently suppressed, or at least as long as they were in the Navy. And the sailor, fortunately, the guy who did it, and this happened very early on, but I knew that guy. He was a very honest guy, and he said, hey, I wasn't thinking, I'm sorry. And he didn't try and pretend like, oh, I didn't see the tag, or wasn't hanging, or didn't make any of this stuff up. The problem is, when a mistake happens, you got to attribute the primary cause, and it's either a special cause, so in other words, a person chose to screw up, or a meteorite landed and whatever, or it's a system. And the way I thought about it was it's the environment. So when you pull the thing back, you say, well, this, he'd been up for a long time. He wasn't trying to make a mistake. There was time pressure, so they were kind of rushing through some blah, blah, blah. So it was really like we put him in a bad situation and then we blamed him for making a mistake. And that's not healthy. In healthy organizations, leaders say, look, I'm going to create the environment where you can be at your best. You And the team still says, no matter what you do to me, I'm still going to have the right behaviors. I'm still going to pay attention. I'm still going to think ahead. I think I'm going to speak up in meetings. I'm going to be vulnerable, blah, 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 no matter what you do. But the leaders say, well, I'm not going to blame you if something, if I don't, I see you not speaking up in a meeting, I'm going to say, oh, Andy, you need to speak up. It's like, well, there's a reason. It doesn't feel safe for Andy to speak up.
And it's not his fault.
Yeah, and it's not his fault. And an and it's like 99-1. For every time you find a problem where the person did it, it's them. There's probably 99 where it's a system problem. So what in toxic organizations, obviously, it's the opposite. The leadership blames the people, and the people blame the culture.
Yeah, it comes down to behavior. So I think we got time for one more question, and then we'll have to wrap up. Eric, you want to read this one out, and then I'll bring us around.
Sure. So has the current pandemic highlighted specific concepts in leadership is language that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah. So the idea in leadership is language is that we, instead of having one group of people think and the other group of people do, we want the whole organization to do thinking and doing. But you don't multitask. You don't think and do at the same time. You either focus, laser focus on doing, or you go really broadly expansive in terms of thinking. The job of the leader in these organizations is to manage the rhythm. So if we start, we change the website, if we launch a product, if we get ready to take off on an airplane, the question is, how long do you do the doing before you pause? Everyone put down your pencils. And let's see where we're at, do a retrospective, let's make a decision about where we're going to go next. That rhythm is what leaders manage. So that sounds like an agile sprint cycle, which it should. Here's the thing. As uncertainty and volatility go up, you got to shorten the cycles. Mm-hmm. So this is true over the course of a project. If you're doing 2-week sprints, you got a 52-week project, you're delivering a big piece of software, and you're doing 2-week sprints at the beginning, you're doing 2-week sprints at the end, I'd say you're under biased towards learning at the beginning and you're under biased towards production at the end. I'd probably do 2-week sprints at the beginning, 1-week sprints at the beginning, and 1-month sprints at the end, or something like that. But the same thing's happening now. So if your organization was working on a 3-week sprint cycle, and now you have COVID and everything is changing, maybe you have 1-week cycles for a while. So I talked about the James Madison student thing. So
unpack that one.
Students teaching leadership, and in the first week, it was 3 weeks. In the first 3 weeks, the students came up, developed, and implemented and started training using 12 new programs that they didn't even have before. Well, their normal cycle was basically go the whole semester and then review how things were going, then go the whole then do the whole next semester. Well, obviously they need to shorten that up. So you got to shorten up the cycles.
Coming up on our time box, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I hope the audience has as well. I want to thank both our panelists, David Marquet and Andy Warshak from Intent-Based Leadership. Tell us a little bit more about the organization, the mission, and the best way to get a hold of you two.
Andy, you want to start?
Yeah, you can get on our website at intentbasedleadership.com, and you can share your story with us. We have resources there. We have free resources. Once a week, we put out a 60 to 90 second nudge with just to nudge you down a different leadership skill. And you can sign up for those on our website. That's sometimes it's David, sometimes it's another of our team members. We have a couple of guys, Peter in Scotland, Jeff in California, and sometimes the nudges come from clients. So we get to hear what's going on with other people as well. So those are some of the resources, and Andy at turntheshiparound.com or David at turntheshiparound.com. You can get a hold of us that way as well. David, you want to add anything?
No, I typed some of that into the chat window. Hey, I appreciate everyone coming out today. Thanks so much. It's tough, and you're going to act. For me, over and over again, it was like I was messing with my head because I wanted to make decisions. I wanted to take control. I wanted to tell people what to do, and I had to resist that over and over and over and over and over and over again. But I saw like it was magic what we were able to achieve.
Fantastic. Eric, now a word from one of our sponsors. Can you tell us a little bit about Agile Velocity, and then I'll fill in about the Agile Uprising?
Yeah, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. So at Agile Velocity, we're outcomes focused as a consulting firm, helping companies achieve the agility that they need to be able to deal with things like we're dealing with today. We focus on building capabilities through a method we call the Path to Agility. And you can see for yourself what we do at pathtoagility.com, or you can visit us at agilevelocity.com. We're not super dogmatic. We don't really tend to promote frameworks as much as helping leaders build the capabilities and help teams achieve the kind of performance that makes them really proud of the work that they do. So it's a real honor for us to be able to partner with companies who are looking to be more adaptable, both in the way that they lead and the value that they create for their customers. So it's obviously very much in tune with what we talked about today. And Andy and David, both of you guys are an inspiration to a lot of us at Agile Velocity, and it's a pleasure to share the time with you. Andy, Clef, you're the best. Thank you for hosting.
I'm here wearing my Agile Uprising cap. You can't see it because it's invisible. We're a purpose-built network that's kind of agnostic. It's global, it's professional, it's between practicing agilists. You can find us at agileuprising.com. We're a couple of different chat boards, a coalition board, a Discord board, and you'll find links at agileuprising.com. To all the attendees, 125 or so, thanks for taking the time, taking the hour. Thanks for your insightful lines of inquiry. And I hope this discussion helps up your level of mastery to lead whatever level you're in today's crazy environment. That's all for now. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend or a colleague. And if this is your first time, why don't you subscribe? That way you'll get the next one. If you'd like to join the discussion, share your stories about effective leadership and good craft beer, please visit us at theagileuprising.com, join the coalition, or the Discord forum. And finally, support from listeners like you will help us to continue to cover our hosting and podcast production costs. See the show notes. You'll find details there on how you can become a patron. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.